The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone. Welcome once again to In Perspective. I am Bob Branco. This is episode 463, dated Friday, May 8th, 2026. Before we continue, allow me to introduce our good friend, colleague, and co-host for today's program, Peter O'Toole. Peter, what's going on today?
It's springtime in Coos Bay, Oregon, which means sun and wind and no rain, and we need the rain. But it is a beautiful day here. It's going to be a beautiful weekend.
You mean no more atmospheric rivers?
Not until November.
Okay. We are partly sunny, 60. Going to have some more rain over the weekend, and typical spring weather is upon us. Before we continue, allow me to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with our producer, Raymond Gay. Thank you for what you do. We appreciate it. Peter from Canada. Thank you for posting our programs on one of your chat boards. It is much appreciated. I want to thank our media outlets for airing us when they do. That's appreciated, along with Jacqueline Sylvia, who is our web designer. She archives our programs on my website. In order for people to find them, they must go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down till you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on them. And you will see most of our archived programs from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I want to say hi to Herbie, who is our facilitator for today's program.
We have host, not facilitator. You're the facilitator. I'm the host.
All right. Herbie is the host for today's program.
Yeah, you're the facilitator, so I'm the one that calls on hands. Anyway.
Thank you, Herbie. We have no streamer for today, but we will definitely make do with that situation. I also want to say hi to two faithful listeners, Melody Halloway and Linda Lambert. Thank you very much for your support. We appreciate it. Today we are here with Kim Charlson. Kim is the executive director of the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library. She's also involved with a lot of other projects, but I thought we would focus a lot about the library. And I must tell you, Kim, I really enjoy the services that your library provides. I really love my digital talking book player. It's very, very handy. It's very convenient. Just pop the book in and read it. I like that invention. It's really worthwhile, I think, to the consumer. And by the way, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. And you can keep talking wonderful things. I'll just sit here and listen.
No, I think you folks provide a very valuable service to the blind population. I really, really do.
Well, thank you very much. And I'll try to be clear when I'm talking about services that anyone who has a talking book library in their state can get versus sort of what's a little different about the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library. So. I don't want to have next week when I open my inbox at work and I'll have, you know, dozens and dozens of requests from people saying, can I be a borrower of the Perkins Library? It doesn't quite work that way.
Tell us how it works.
But we will talk about that. So,
okay.
So let me start with a little bit of history. Because Perkins is unique in its placement, in its, you know, the first school for the blind in the United States, founded in 1829, and it's coming up. We're going to have our 200th anniversary in 3 years. So we're starting to make some big plans for that year. So the founder and first executive director of Perkins was named Samuel Gridley Howe, and he was, approached by a lot of what, of the era were called Boston Brahmins. And Boston Brahmins were the upper class folks who had money in Boston, who believed in good deeds and good works and helping the less fortunate. And their motivation was, we need to do something to help children who are blind because they're not getting any education. So they approached Sam and they asked him to become the executive director, and he agreed. And he, one of the first things he did was go to Europe to explore how Europe was approaching teaching blind children. And he went to both London and to Paris, and he was much more interested in what was available in France as far as services and books. So they had books that were in raised print that they called, they called it Raised Line, basically. And Samuel Gridley Howe was very intrigued because he wanted to bring literacy back to Perkins to make it possible for blind children to learn to read. So the Raised Line books, when they came back to Massachusetts, Samuel Gridley Howe decided that he needed to collaborate with a couple of printers, because Boston Line Type ended up being the medium. This was before Braille. This was in about 1840. So Boston Line Type was the first format of tactile reading for blind people. And it was raised print lettering. And until the 1980s, some of the magazines published by National Braille Press had Boston Line Type on the cover, and you could feel the letters. Well, they were pretty small. I mean, I have samples of them in my office that I've discovered over the years. We have many archival copies of different books in our archives at Perkins, and I can read the uppercase letters and I can read the lowercase letters by touch, but I cannot read, I can read the numbers. I cannot read lowercase letters. They are just small. They're, you know, people probably tell Braille readers all the time, you know, I don't know how you learned to read that. Well, we did. And probably that's exactly what the people that read Boston Line Type would do. So Samuel Gridley Howe's philosophy was that he wanted the reading system for blind people to not be a barrier between them and their sighted family and friends. So if there was a question that came up or something the blind person didn't understand, they could show the book to somebody and point out the word that was giving them a problem, and the sighted person could read it. So it was an interesting concept around kind of universal design way before its time. But what was interesting is it had to be produced on a printing press. So the only things blind people had to read were the books that sighted people picked out for them. The Bible, Shakespeare, classics. That was pretty much all that was available in Boston Line Type. And the process was pretty arduous to produce a book. So my philosophy has always been there were two reasons that Boston Line Type failed. The first one was that there was no way for blind people to write it on their own. Yeah, you could not do, you know, we didn't all have little printing presses in our pockets. So there was no way to replicate that as a writing system. It was only a reading system. So, and the second issue that I think was kind of the demise of Boston Line Type, although Perkins circulated it until probably the turn of the century, the 1900s, was the advent of Braille coming to the United States around the 1860s, and it went to the Missouri School for the Blind first, and then was quickly adopted by other East Coast schools like Perkins and Overbrook and other places. So,
my goodness.
Yeah, exactly. So Braille came to Perkins, and, you know, they had Boston Line Type, they had Braille, and many of you probably know about, you know, the famous War of the Dots, because back then we had, you know, we had Braille, we had Line Type, we had New York Points, we had just so many different kinds of Braille, but it didn't get unified in what we used to call a standard English Braille until 1931. So there were all these codes around, and Helen Keller wrote a letter to Congress in 1905, basically saying, you know, please, we need a national library program. We need a system of tactile reading for blind people that is universal among all of us. I shouldn't have to learn 5 different codes to read books. And that's exactly what she had to do when she went to Radcliffe, was do that. She would get her books wherever she could, and they would come in whatever code they were in. So.
And I didn't realize how complicated things were back then.
So Perkins started circulating books around 1850, and it was the only program anywhere in the country that shared their books with blind people. So we actually did mail books wrapped literally in brown paper with string. So if you want to sing the song, you can, but, it was how we sent them. And, you know, we did share them around the country because, you know, the National Library Service for the Blind and Print Disabled didn't come into being until 1931. So we had, you know, 80 years of no programs, no services. In the late 1890s, some major cities in the United States started reading rooms for blind people where you could go to the public library and librarians would read aloud to you in a story. So you'd go back every week and you'd get, you know, an hour of reading time. That was it. There was nothing else until 1931 when NLS was formed, and that was formed around Braille books for adults. And that was what we had until 1934 when the first record player was introduced. They were manufactured by the WPA, Work Progress Administration, I think, if my history's right, under Roosevelt and the New Deal. And they manufactured, record players, big, big record players, like 2 feet wide and about 18 inches deep with the speaker that would open up, the lid opened. And, but these were the biggest. Perkins has one in our library. And to best of my knowledge, and I've been told by NLS, there are only 4 of them left in the United States. So we have one of them. NLS, I think, has the rest under lock and key, probably. So, you know, that's when records came to the program, and we had Braille books and records up through the, you know, basically into the 1970s. When we started to have flexible discs, some of you may remember those. And that was when cassettes were introduced into the program, and cassettes carried us a long way. The 4-track cassette started with 2-track, and then it went to 4-track. And we had 4-track cassette tape books for almost all the way up until about like 2009, 2010, because that's when digital cartridges came out, and we started doing books on digital. And 2013 was the first time we had downloadable books from Bard as a pilot. So that's kind of the chronology, and forgive me if I took a little too long to share that, but I think it's interesting, and, you know, really, really does give us a perspective of how far we've come with respect to accessible library services. So most of you are probably pretty familiar with, you know, the new digital cartridge format and downloading your books. And, you know, we started in 2009 with what we call the standard player, the DS1, and the advanced player, the DA1. And that's what's been carrying us for about the last 15, 16 years. But just, you know, about a year ago now, we started rolling out the DA2, which is a more advanced model of digital player. It still has the slot for your cartridges in the front, but it's a much more sophisticated machine, because it can connect to Wi-Fi and allow you to use your player to access Bard. So it does have a, It has some extra keys that the earlier digital players don't have. And one of those sets of keys is what I call the cursor cross, up arrow, down, left, right arrow, and then kind of an info key in the center. And that's how you access, if you want to do Bard, there's a menu button and you select Bard off of the menu. And then you can use that arrow key to up or down arrows and spell out what you're looking for. It's doable. I think sometimes it gets a little tedious going up and down arrow and then pressing the crescent moon button to enter in the letter, not the one in the center of your cursor cross. That'll take you out of your search. Cause it's the info button. So that's not, it's kind of, I don't know. It almost feels like natural to push the button in the center because that's what you do on other devices, but not on the digital player. So, but there is a shortcut for doing that up and down arrow and spelling out a word. There's a USB port on the right side of the player, and you can plug in a USB keyboard to your digital player, and then you're able to type in the exact, you know, the author name, last name, first name, or the DB number of a book you want on Bard, with the USB keyboard, press enter and it will download the book right into your player. Once you have it set up to do that, you have to, you know, create your account basically with the machine. You have to get connected to Bard. And once you've done all that setup, which I admit is kind of the toughest part. But once you get past that, as Bob said, the machine can do so much for you.
Well, I have the portable one, Kim, the portable digital, where you just plop the cartridge in.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it.
You know, have it connected to anything. Probably we're talking about the same machine, but I like what mine does. It's really cool.
It is. It's easy. It's easy. And that's what it needs to be. I mean, it's great that we have the sophistication of the new player that will allow you to connect to Bard. But the majority of people that use the Talking Book program nationwide, 70% of them are over the age of 65. And that's due to age-related vision loss and other types of disabilities, primarily vision loss. And so you've got, you know, many, many, many people who didn't grow up dealing with their blindness and are very insecure about what they're trying to do and what they're trying to accomplish. And, you know, even encouraging them sometimes to take the player out of the box is a big deal. They're afraid they'll break it or hurt it or something. So we often have to just urge them to give it a try. If you need somebody to help you take it out of the box, that's okay. The machine is sturdy. It's not going to break. You're not going to hurt it. So, you know, the machine was developed for that population, but there's many, many people who use, you know, Victor Streams and download from Bard. Within the last 2 years, the program has now, Braille e-reader devices, a HumanWare e-reader and a ZoomX e-reader. And we're primarily using the HumanWare ones for the most part these days. Patrons like them a lot who are Braille readers, and they, you know, it's a huge advance forward for Braille readers to be able to download their books and have a device they can read them on. You know, when I was a kid, I used to be able to take 2 volumes of Braille on my family vacation, and that's all we had room for. You know, now you can put 100 books on your e-reader device and take it with you and never run out of reading material. It's a pretty amazing feature, and I wasn't sure we were ever going to make it to the time when there would be a free loan refreshable Braille device from the library program, but I'm really happy that we've been distributing it now, you know, for 2 years. So it's a great addition to our program. I'm really, really happy that we now have, you know, an accessible Braille reader for people as well as our Talking Book player.
Kim, you mentioned earlier in the show that there are different services between Perkins and the standard Bard library. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. And I'll start by telling you just kind of a little bit of background. I won't go too far back, but I think it's interesting how I became, an executive director of a Braille and Talking Book Library in the United States. So, originally I was going to become an attorney. And when I graduated with my bachelor's degree in political science, I sort of had one of the things that happens to a lot of us who graduate from college. And that is, oh my God, I can't go back to 3 more years of school right now. So maybe I'll just go get a job. Like that was a simple thing to do. But, so I thought, well, I'll go get a job. So I applied for 2 jobs. One was in a real estate office as the office manager. The other one was at the Oregon State Library Braille and Talking Book Service. And I bet you can guess which job I actually got, which was at the Oregon State Library. And my job was to train talking book narrators. They wanted to start a volunteer narrator program and to train Braille transcribers for a Braille production program to help produce materials for people in Oregon. And I did that. And often when things happen in an office, you get a boss who hired you and was fabulous and great. And then they move on and a new boss comes in. And, you know, I was scratched my head. I said, my gosh, I could run the library better than this person. But when will I be able to do that? If I don't get a master's degree in library science, how would I ever do that? And one day on my desk, and I still don't know how it showed up, but this envelope showed up on my desk, and it was all about a federally funded fellowship program for students with disabilities to get their master's degrees in library science. I was like, wow, this like fell out of the sky right on my head. How can I ignore this? I need to apply for this. So I did. And the one thing I didn't know at the time was, you know, the university that had the degree program was in Denton, Texas. It was the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas. I lived in Salem, Oregon. And I was like, wow, Texas is like another country. I mean, it was, what am I going to do? Well, obviously I decided to, you know, pack up. I left Brian home at our house in Oregon and I said, please, dodge the bill collectors. We'll make it through. And I'll see you at Christmas. So I went off to grad school for a year, got my master's degree in library science. And, you know, a lot of the times when I was in class, I would say, you know, how would you provide services to people with disabilities in a public library? And they'd look at me like I had 3 heads, you know, like, what are you talking about? I said, well, you know, you need to know about how to make accommodations for people when they come to your public library or how to find the talking book library that's in your state and make referrals. And, you know, nobody ever wanted to talk about how do we provide service to people with disabilities. So that sort of made me more determined that there was a place for me in the library world. You know, and I had already determined that the world maybe didn't need one more lawyer, that maybe my focus needed to be on access to information and access to library services. And so I went in that direction. And because of the timing when I was in grad school, computers and libraries had become a thing, thank goodness, in the late 1980s, early 1990s. Card catalogs were disappearing. And things were more accessible. Databases were coming online where you could do your own online research. And I was able to do the tasks within a library setting if they had an automation system. And so that made it a viable thing for me to do. Prior to that, it was just very print oriented. Not too many people who are blind would have gone to work in a library because you were facing a lot of lack of accessibility everywhere you turned. But that changed. And I think an article was written about me being like one of the first totally blind people to get a master's degree in library science in one of the journals. And Perkins saw the article and they reached out to me and they said, you know, we're interested in interviewing you. We have a deputy director position and we'd like to interview for it. Would you consider that? And so I did, and they offered me the job, and, you know, I had to make the big decision, like, wow, you know, Boston, Salem, Oregon, wow, 3,000 miles away. And all my family and Brian's family live in Oregon. And, but we did. And it was, you know, it's a big move. It's hard to move across the country when you don't know anybody at the place you're landing. But we made it work. We love it here in Massachusetts. And I worked as the assistant director for 16 years. And then in 2001, I became the director of the Perkins Library. So that's my long story about how I got there. And I've always believed that there's more to library service for people who are blind or print disabled than just having audiobooks, braille books, and sending them out to people and having magazines. I felt like we should have a full service library like a public library. And many libraries today do more than just the NLS offerings. But I was very focused on, you know, I know what I think, you know, patrons need because I have my finger on the pulse and I live it every day just like they do. And I want to bring more of accessibility to what we have. So things like Newsline, the Perkins Library is the state sponsor for the Newsline program that is an amazingly popular service for access to newspapers every day. And we've enhanced our service, as most states do, by paying to add papers in our states that aren't part of the base service from Newsline. So we've added many of the papers, including the newspaper for the town that Bob lives in, that we added a couple of years ago, the New Bedford Standard Times. So we've got about 12 or so local Massachusetts papers that we've added over the years. Other kinds of services that we have, and again, I'll say, you know, many other Talking Book libraries have a variety of these. So we have a recording studio where we produce primarily books of local regional interest. We don't do bestsellers and things like that because that's the kind of content that comes from NLS. They produce those, or they have agreements with commercial publishers to share audiobook files with NLS so that they can streamline and get those audiobooks faster to readers. But the books that are about, you know, Massachusetts or New England or whatever your state is, some of the local magazines, those don't get produced by NLS because the readership is a little more limited and a little more focused. And those are the kinds of things that we do in our recording studio. We produce Yankee Magazine, which is popular all over the country. And our version, our recording is shared with all the other network libraries around the country to add to any individual patrons' reading list to have copied onto cartridge. So we're proud of that because that meets the national standard for production of magazines. And we do that every other month. Yankee comes out 6 times a year. And we do Boston Magazine, which does not come under that same program. Yankee was very rigorous, and I promised my staff that I wouldn't put them through that again. NLS was very demanding and, you know, had just a whole lot of requirements to make those recordings absolutely the best they could be for any of our listeners. So, we still follow those guidelines, but, with Boston, it's a monthly, so we have to turn it around a little faster so we don't go through quite the rigorous process we do for Yankee because we want to make Yankee the best we can. So we have about 50 volunteer narrators. They're all volunteers who have been trained. They've had to go through an audition process, and they're selected, screened and selected and trained to record, and we have them work in teams. So while the narrator with their book is in the booth recording, their partner is outside the booth monitoring the computer, recording digitally, and reading along in the print text. So after about an hour and 10 minutes or so, they switch places, they switch their books, the new narrator's in the booth, and the one who finished their session is now reading along in their partner's print book to make sure that there's no mistakes or skipped words or anything like that, so that we can hopefully keep the copy as, you know, perfect as possible. But we do also have volunteers that are called reviewers that listen to the recordings, and they drop in little digital markers for the recording studio staff to go back and prep a correction worksheet when the assignment is done, to make all the corrections at one time. And with today's technology, just like with Word, you can copy and paste a word into a document. You don't have to retype something. Well, the same thing works with audio. You can copy and paste these recording corrections into the old file, delete the bad part. And this is what happens with this show or any of the shows you hear on ACB radio. The wizards behind the scenes edit those shows down and make them sound absolutely fantastic because they're great editors. And that's what we have in our studio. We have a Braille production department that produces books for our collection, magazines for our collection, and we also produce some Braille for the Perkins campus for departments that don't have their own Braille embossing equipment. So the education departments at Perkins have access to that for their students. So we don't Braille for the students at Perkins, but we do Braille for the marketing department, the development department, the president's office, Perkins International, any place where they might need something produced in Braille. We do that for departments that don't have that capacity. So some of the other things, we are in the process of launching this summer a tactile map collection. So years ago, NLS had a tactile map collection, but it kind of disappeared. Things got loaned out. And as you can imagine with maps, sometimes people want to continue to hold on to them. So sometimes they never came back. But I ventured out, decided to be brave, and we've started a tactile map collection with about 50 different maps, like Europe and Asia and South America, a lot of state maps, country maps of Europe and that sort of thing. And we're going to be launching that this summer, opening it up for our patrons to borrow. And we actually, in our Braille department, in our Braille program, we provide services and have done so for New England borrowers, all of New England, for since like the late 1880s. And Perkins has just done that because Vermont and New Hampshire and Rhode Island are pretty tiny little states. So they're not going to have a whole big Braille lending library collection for, you know, 22 Braille readers in the state. So we provide that Braille service for them for a fee, and it's a nominal fee. And we also do the same thing for Braille readers in Washington, D.C., North Carolina, and Tennessee. And I have to say, if there's any Tennessee folks, you are my best borrowers of all. You read more stuff than Massachusetts people, bar none. So people like to read in Tennessee. They're great. So we also have an assistive technology manager on staff, and he's there to help support BARD users, both Braille BARD users and audio BARD users. But last year, we also started a program. I call it Library of Things. And you may have heard this in your own communities. A lot of public libraries have libraries of things, where you can go to the public library and you can borrow a sander, because you have a project, you're going to sand your deck and you're going to fix it up and make it nice for the summer. But you don't want to buy a sander because they cost like $100 or something. So the library can loan you a sander for the weekend, and you can go and use it and then take it back to the library. And, you know, your project's done and everything's good. Well, I thought, you know, why not have an assistive technology library of things where we have just interesting things that people might be interested in checking out before they decided they were going to buy it. And not overly expensive things. You know, one of my favorite things in our library of things is talking AM FM radio. It's a Sangian radio. A lot of people may have one. They run about $130, but it speaks all of the frequencies. When you're tuning in with the dial to find a station, it'll actually say, you know, 101.5, 101.6, 101.7, and you can find the station that you are interested in using it. All the buttons, the features, you know, AM, FM, there's some presets, things like that. Everything talks on that radio. It's one of our most popular items to loan out because people want to try it. You know, I think blind people love radios. So, and they're,
I know people who have the Sangian radios.
It's a really nice radio. So, you know, put it on your Christmas list. Maybe it'll show up. It's worth it. I have one. I like it a lot. So we have other kinds of talking devices. We've got some digital pocket recorders. We even have some cooking things, like you guys have probably heard about. There's a cooking pot that has a locking lid. So then it's a pasta pot, and it's kind of been marketed for years for blind people as a way to cook your pasta. And then the lid locks on so you can move the pot over to your sink and you can tip it upside down and the water will drain out and the pasta will not fall out in your sink. So that's the accessible pasta pot. We've got some games. We've got some balls, you know, like beat ball and the softy ball, softball, that kind of thing, basketball. And it's a fun kind of program where we loan this device, whatever it is, for 4 weeks, and people can try it out and then they have to return it. And we also then provide, you know, if you call us and say, I'm sending it back, but I really want to buy one. Where did you get it? Well, we have the information on what it is, where you can buy it. So if somebody does want to, you know, take that next step and purchase it, we give them the information on where we purchased them. So yeah.
Go finish.
I was just going to tell you about the demo center. So it's kind of like the Library of Things, but the demo center has more pricey things in it. We can't loan those out, but you can schedule an appointment and come in and work with the assistive technology manager. He'll show you how to use them, how they work. So one of the more popular things right now that we have in our demo center is about every kind of talking glasses that are out there on the market. You know, everybody knows about the Meta glasses, and there's a Giga glasses and Envision glasses, and you know, they all do similar things, but then there's like slight variations between them on, you know, how well they might do one thing or another. And Corey, who's my assistive technology specialist, is an expert, and he can show people how to, you know, what's the feature of this one that you might be interested in. You can try this one. You can try this one. But, you know, we don't loan them out because they're expensive. They cost like $400 or sometimes more, but people want to see them. They don't want to just go out and buy Meta Ray-Ban glasses because somebody said they were cool. You know, you like to have a little more comfort if you're going to spend $400 that it really is going to be something that's going to help you. So, we have a WeWalk cane, which is kind of the new cool sort of cane. It costs about $800, but it's got GPS built in. It's got little speakers in its handle. So you could program in a destination and the cane will give you guidance as you're walking down the street and provide those directions like GPS does. We're early adopters for the Glide when it comes out, so people can try it with our library. We don't have it yet because nobody has it yet, but we're all waiting. And that's kind of the sort of thing. And then we have note takers and, some higher end low vision devices. So it's a lot of tech people want to see. We even have a graffiti and a monarch and the very expensive, you know, graphics design for Braille graphics devices that are out there on the market that, you know, people want to see, they're curious about, they're not likely to go buy a $17,000 graphics display, but they really, really want to see it. So those are the kind of things. So Peter, you had a question?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to 2001 because I vaguely remember this as a member of ACB and didn't know you at all. But there was a lot of buzz that when you became the executive director of the Perkins Library. And I'm just curious about sort of the surroundings that happened because, you know, as you said, it's unusual for a blind person to work in a library at that time, and especially to be a executive director of a library for blind folk, and especially a woman.
Yes.
So talk about how that sort of how that happened and the publicity you got out of that and, you know, how your life changed, if at all, you know, when all that happened.
Well, yes, it did. And it was kind of my career goal to be the director of a Braille and Talking Book Library somewhere in the United States. And I, you know, I hoped it would be Perkins, but when I started at Perkins 41 years ago, I've been there a long time. I wasn't, you know, I didn't think I'd be there for 41 years. And no plans to retire at this point. You know, I'm getting there, but not quite yet. So there was, I'm pretty sure there was one other person in the United States who was a director of a Braille and Talking Book Library, and her name was Karen Kenninger. And she went on in 2012, 2013, I think it was, to become the director of NLS. So her name may sound very familiar.
Yeah.
So there was only one other person when I took the job in, as executive director who was running a Braille and Talking Book Library program. I'm really, you know, mentorship is something I believe in, and I've mentored a lot of my own staff. My deputy director is low vision. And I have like four other staff members who are legally blind, either totally blind or legally blind. And I've tried to, you know, make opportunities for people with disabilities within my organization and in Perkins at large. So today I'm happy to say that those connections and mentoring of colleagues, there are now, five states that have a, no, six actually. California, Northern in Sacramento, New York, Albany, Michigan has a blind executive director, myself, and a librarian in Virginia runs one of the sub-regional libraries. So there are now, you know, practically like five times more people than when I first started working in the field who are directors of libraries who are blind. And I think that's really great. And there's many more blind people working within the Braille and Talking Book Library system across the country than there were, you know, 30 or 40 years ago.
And then another sort of question. You obviously were president of ACB for 6 years or more. I guess it was six years.
Uh-huh.
You were also had this executive director job, which those are two full-time jobs at least. How did you find the time to do all that stuff, and keep a marriage together or whatever other social stuff you're
yes.
doing?
Well, I will acknowledge that the time that I served as ACB president, I was very busy. I would work, and I had a very flexible boss who said, I realize sometimes you're going to have ACB meetings in the day. So I expect you to be accountable for the time that you're working on an ACB thing. And I want that time back. So there was a lot of times when I worked, you know, late into the evening, just catching back up on my work duties or going to ACB meetings. So it was a busy time. And you know, the staff of ACB also knew that I had a full-time job. You know, I see the hours that past presidents like Dan Spoon and Deb Cook Lewis put in. And I said, you know, I don't know how they manage it. I could never have done it. And it's just the evolution of how ACB has evolved and changed and grown since 2019 when I left the presidency of ACB, with the community, with everything that's happening, with just everything's grown and expanded, and there's just so many more things that ACB is doing than we were doing between 2013 and 2019. And I marvel at, you know, their accomplishments and the time they had spent in the role. But, you know, the staff at ACB really made it possible for me to succeed as president. And I'm honored to still be a member of the ACB board of directors as in the role of past president, because as you know, Dan Spoon, who followed me as president of ACB, now is a staff member of ACB. So he can't be on the board and work for ACB. So I continue to fill that role until Deb Cook Lewis steps down from being president. And then either, you know, Dan will fill that role again when he doesn't work for ACB, or Deb will fill that role when it happens. But
we have about 10 more minutes. I do want to give some opportunities to some people who are.
I would love that. I never told you how much I talk, Bob. So, you know,
you do a good job.
That's apologize.
Right, you're providing us with wonderful information.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So you're listening to In Perspective. Our guest is Kim Charlson. She's the executive director of the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library, former president of ACB. And Herbie, do we have any hands raised at this particular time?
Yes, we do. We have a couple. And let's start off with Robert Acosta.
Robert from California. Welcome.
I'll be brief.
I saw
a library and I said, how nice. We love our libraries, until I saw the name Kim Charlson and I knew that I had to be here.
Oh,
this
thank you,
the,
Bob.
One of the great women and great friends in this country. And I just don't know what to say, except I want to ask this question. Mm-hmm. Braille Institute now is having workshops via Zoom because you got to go 40 miles to class.
Yeah.
I don't have time.
Yeah. Yep.
For that, you know, to take a bus or whatever. Are you, and I may have stepped away. I did step away. Do you guys have workshops that do outreach around the community?
Yes.
Thank you.
Absolutely. We do a lot of outreach. I have a full-time outreach person, and I have two blind women that work as consultants for me on Cape Cod because it's a little more isolated there, harder to get to things. And they're doing a fantastic job. I just love being able to have people who use the program be spokespersons for the program. They're bringing in a lot of new patrons that are older, and it's great. So we also do, the Zoom activities. Yay to Zoom. We learned how to do it in the pandemic, and I have about, 15 or so different programs, from trivia to book clubs to audio described movies to just like old time radio programs, all kinds of informational talks and some classes on Zoom for our patrons. Library Without Walls started at Perkins.
And just so you know, we have three more raised hands currently.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks,
thank you, Bob.
Okay,
Herbie, who's next?
Jessica.
Hello, Jessica. Jessica.
Hello. This is Jessica.
Yes.
This is Jessica. And, so I was just curious, Kim, if you're the one who wrote the book, The Drawing with Your Perkins Brailler.
You are very good. You get a gold star. Yes, that was me. I did that in 2009 to celebrate the bicentennial birth year of Louis Braille. And Drawing with Your Perkins Brailler is a book that Perkins sells in Braille and large print that gives you step-by-step directions to use your Perkins Brailler to draw pictures. So it sounds like you know about it.
I've got it in Braille. I found it on Amazon, believe it or not. I couldn't find it on Bookshare. I couldn't find it on Bard, but I found it on Amazon.
Yeah, wonderful. Yes, we do sell it at Perkins on Amazon. Yep.
My other question was, is there any way that I can get my hands on a graffiti? And can someone help me get one? I'm totally blind and I'm in Georgia. I don't know what to do, but I would love to have one of these graffitis. If anyone can help me.
Well, the graffiti's very pricey, but the HumanWare Braille e-reader is available through Georgia, which is a smaller kind of pocket size. You know, you can borrow that from your library. They can provide you with that, and give you guidance on how to use it and get books. You can either get books downloaded from Bard, or you can get Braille books sent to you on a cartridge. The e-readers come with a short little cable that you can connect to the e-reader and then connect to the cartridge. And the e-reader will copy the Braille books off of the cartridge automatically and put them into your e-reader. And then you can read Braille books with it. So it's pretty amazing.
Thank you, Jess. You might try that. We have lots of people. So, just so you know, we have
9 minutes left.
Okay. Yeah.
9 minutes left. Go right ahead.
I'll try to be short with my answers.
Yeah.
All right. So try to be short on the question side of things too. Next we have Melissa.
Welcome, Melissa.
Good. Thank you. Good afternoon. Mr. Branko and Mr. Altschul and Kim.
Hello.
I just wanted to say, I didn't really have a question. I just wanted to say that I met you and Brian at the Washington Council of the Blind Convention. I think it was in 2014.
I remember that.
It was in Tacoma.
That.
And yeah. What a delight the two of you were. And, just congratulations on everything you're doing. And, thank you for being the first female president of ACB, and what an amazing accomplishment that was. So thank you, and God bless.
Thank you so much.
And tell Brian hello from all of us.
I will. Thank you.
And you're always welcome.
Tell Brian hello from me too. I met Brian on several occasions, I believe.
Yeah.
And, he was the head of technology at the Carroll Center.
At the Carroll Center. He's trained a lot of people in Massachusetts how to use their technology. So yeah.
Yes. All right.
Herbie, who do we have? Next.
Carla.
Hi there.
Hello, Carla.
Hi there, how you doing? And I want to thank you so much and NLS for all the many hours of pleasure and education you've given me. And the many faces of Bard things, and I've met you and Brian too.
Yes.
But anyhow, my question or suggestion is, and I've talked to this, about this on the many faces of Bard. You know how there are tutorials for the e-readers and the talking book player and I don't know if there is for the smart speaker. I think it would be neat to have them compiled either on something that you could download, because as it is now, you got to look for all that stuff on YouTube and all this. That I was wondering if there's any way Bard could make them all available on one cartridge, or at least in one place, in one category with electronic files, so one could download them.
Well, that's a really good suggestion. So before we end this show, I'm going to give my email address. Okay. So if you shoot me an email, which you might even have it already, who knows? I will look into that, because I think there might be a place on the NLS website that has a lot of that stuff put all in one spot to make it a whole lot easier. And I can share that link with you.
Okay. Well, and again, thank you for all you
thank
do.
Thank you. Thank you,
Carla.
While we're thinking about it,
we do have two more hands, Kim, just so you know. Go.
Why don't you give out your email address so we can, people who want it can.
Perfect. Perfect. So I'm going to give you a phone number and an email address. My email is my name. So it's kim.charlson, CHARLSON, no E, @perkins.org. So it's kim.charlson@perkins.org.
kim.charlson@perkins.org. Very good.
And the phone number is 617-972-7240.
Okay.
All right. We'll take another question, maybe.
Herbie, you say we have two more.
Yes, we do. Next is Jeanette.
Hey, Kim.
Hi,
good
there.
Good to hear you as always.
Thank you.
I have a friend who is currently a Bard user. Her computer has died.
Oh.
I am in the process of helping her with the book list. Mm-hmm. Could I submit it on her behalf and
Absolutely.
Ask a librarian to create a cartridge for her?
Yes, definitely. If you want to send it to me, that would be perfect.
I will
I'll
send
make
it
sure
to
that
you.
Happens. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeanette.
Thanks, Jeanette. Okay, and who's next, Herbie?
Patricia is currently our last hand.
Patricia.
Okay. Patricia. Actually, Bob, it's Trish.
Oh, hi, Trish.
Hi, okay. And I just wanted to come in here and say hello to Kim. Kim, Patricia Lepofsky, it's
hi.
Been so long.
It has
since
been.
I've talked to you, and I'm just here to say hello and say that you sound wonderful, and I'm so glad you're doing well. How's everything going on your end? Pretty good?
It is going well. Thank you for asking. And, you know, I will share really quickly that that I had, this past year I had a bout with breast cancer and, had to have a left side mastectomy. I had reconstruction in January. I'm cancer free and, you know, also an advocate for breast cancer, early detection, because that's what saved my life. So especially important to get those mammograms, ladies. So thank you, Pat.
Right. I agree.
And we are at the 5 minute mark.
And just for information purposes, Bob, I met Kim many years ago. We won't say how many in dog guide school. We were there in class together getting
dogs. Exactly. That's right.
All right. Well, Kim, you take good care. Good talking to you.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Trent. And Kim, congratulations on your cancer survival.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, Kim, we have very little time, and we need to get you back because there's so many things I wanted to ask you.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
You never had a chance to do it, and that's not your fault. You did a terrific job in talking about what we asked you to talk about. I wanted you to sort of reflect on what are the challenges that libraries are facing, and I suspect that they're different for libraries serving blind folk versus, you know, other libraries. What are the challenges that you guys are experiencing? What do you anticipate happening over the next few years?
Well, we are in challenging times, and the past year has been really tricky because a lot of states rely on federal funding from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, or IMLS, and the current administration wants to dismantle that organization that funds libraries all over the country, not just talking book libraries, but all sorts of libraries, millions of dollars worth of funding. So they took it away earlier in the year, but then the court case was won and it got reinstated. And now it's time for the budget, you know, at the federal level. The administration didn't put any funding in. I think Congress will put the funding back because they had a tremendous hue and cry when the funding was taken away, that libraries are so important to every single state and every single municipality that has them. So I really hope, you know, people will pay attention to the funding for their Braille and Talking Book Library, but also their local public library. Because I think we're going to have to, you know, be strong advocates for libraries in the years to come.
And talk a little bit about, I mean, every time I turn around, I see an article about book censoring.
We have about a minute or so.
Talk a little about that.
Book banning and book censoring is a huge issue. There's, you know, libraries are all based on the First Amendment and the right to read and to have something available, and to take it away because you feel that the content is inappropriate is not what America is all about.
It's for us to decide.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's a serious issue in public libraries. I'm happy to say it's not an issue in Braille and Talking Book libraries. I've had people tell me that we had horrible books in our collection, and I won't disagree with them. There are some horrible books in our collection, but, you know, we have the right to have them because somebody might want that book. So,
yes.
I'm a very big supporter of the First Amendment and the right to read. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share.
And thank you for being on In Perspective with us. Our time has expired. We would love to have you back someday for sure. We can get into more of this and on other topics. And again, congratulations on your cancer surviving, and good luck in the future, and keep up the good work with the library. It's very, very important.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Peter. It was great to be a part of your program.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone. Go safe with God's abundant blessings, everyone, and have a good week.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is another important message from the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office, a civil rights complaint. The Attorney General's Civil Rights Division fights discrimination, works to ensure that all people are given an equal opportunity to participate in civic society, and protects individual rights of free speech and privacy. If you believe a company, business, or organization has violated your rights or discriminated against you, you can file a complaint with the Civil Rights Division. For contact information, go to mass.gov/AGO/civil-rights-complaint.